From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On this edition of Fresh Air, Cambodia under the UN peace agreement. The Khmer Rouge, among the worst mass murderers in history, have returned under the terms of the agreement to compete in forthcoming elections. We'll talk with Stan Sesser, who reports on Cambodia in the current issue of The New Yorker. Also, actress Christine Lottie on the frustrations of a feminist in Hollywood. She stars in the new film Leaving Normal. And TV critic David Bianculli reviews the sexiest shows on cable. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. A federal grand jury has subpoenaed the expense records of Dan Rostenkowski, the chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee. The expense records of two other lawmakers and of the House Sergeant-at-Arms have also been subpoenaed in a probe of the House Post Office. The congressmen are Austin Murphy and Joseph Coulter, both Democrats from Pennsylvania. This apparently broadens the post office investigation. Until now, the probe had focused on embezzlement and drug dealing by House employees rather than on possible wrongdoing by members of Congress. Officials with the Intelsat Consortium report that their once-stranded satellite is now well on its way to its proper orbit. The satellite was rescued last night in a history-making mission by the Space Shuttle astronauts. Dave Pignanelli, a member station WMFE, reports.
The Intelsat 6 satellite was blasted toward its proper orbit this afternoon after officials fired its newly attached rocket motor. The Endeavour crew, which rescued the satellite last night, watched the rocket firing from a distance of 400 miles away. The satellite will eventually park in an orbit more than 22,000 miles above the Earth. Over the next several weeks, ground controllers will make slight adjustments to its orbit before checking it out for use. The 9,000-pound spacecraft will relay communications around the globe, including July coverage of the Summer Olympics in Barcelona, Spain. Intelsat officials say the satellite will bring in more than $1 billion over the next decade or so. For National Public Radio, I'm Dave Pignanelli reporting.
The Bosnian capital has come under its worst bombardment of the war as Yugoslav army troops shell the city from the surrounding hills. Heavy casualties are reported. United Nations peacekeepers pulled out of Sarajevo shortly after a UN observer was wounded when a hotel housing the UN team was hit by mortar fire. Pierre Vickery reports.
Throughout the day, hundreds of mortar, artillery, and rocket shells rained down on Sarajevo from Yugoslav army batteries in hills overlooking the capital. Bosnian radio reported extensive damage, with shops and homes destroyed, and many buildings in the city, including a hotel housing UN peacekeepers, hit by mortar fire. Confused attempts to secure a ceasefire failed, and bitter street fighting continued well into the Sarajevo night, as the Yugoslav army, backed by tanks and armored vehicles, attempted to prevent troops loyal to the Bosnian government from breaking out of the Serbian siege of the city. For National Public Radio, this is Pierre Vickery in Zagreb.
The House has approved legislation providing more than $800 million in emergency loans and grants to help rebuild businesses destroyed during the Los Angeles riots. Some money would also be available for flood-damaged businesses in Chicago. The legislation now goes on to the Senate. Stock prices fell on Wall Street today. The Dow lost 23 points to close at 3368.88. This is NPR. The government says stocks of unsold goods increased in March due to slower business sales growth. The Commerce Department reports that total inventories on the shelves of manufacturers, wholesalers, and retailers edged up by 0.4% in March. This is the first rise in inventory since December. Analysts say this illustrates that the nation's economic recovery is painfully slow. Governor Bill Clinton told educators and students in East Los Angeles today that equal educational opportunity will be the cornerstone of his presidency. NPR's Claudio Sanchez reports.
Governor Clinton told students and teachers on the campus of East Los Angeles Community College that education reform is meaningless unless it's fair to all children, and that the Bush administration's push for private school choice and vouchers was evidence that the president was putting the interests of the rich before those of the working poor. President Bush, Clinton said, has a trickle-down education policy. Clinton denounced the administration's unwillingness to fully fund Head Start or to help more poor and middle-class families get college loans. But without missing a beat, he endorsed reforms that the Bush administration claims as its own: world-class academic standards, a national examination system, and dropout prevention. Clinton's most original proposals, a national apprenticeship program and allowing college graduates to repay their loans by working with the poor, got some applause. But political observers say Clinton has to start drawing more distinctions between his education plan and the president's. I'm Claudio Sanchez reporting.
Britain's High Court has rejected an appeal by Olympia and York developers to delay a $240 million payment to the U.S. investment bank Morgan Stanley. The payment is for property in Olympia and York's London Canary Wharf project. The struggling international developer claims the payment wasn't due until June 30th, while the bank says it was due this past December. The court ruled last month that the payment was late, a decision appealed by Olympia and York and rejected today. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Cambodia in the second half of the 70s was the site of the killing fields when the Khmer Rouge slaughtered hundreds of thousands of their own people. Cambodia is now the site of the biggest UN peacekeeping operation in history. By the summer, there will be almost 16,000 soldiers, 3,600 police, and 2,400 civilians under the UN banner. My guest, Stan Sesser, reports on Cambodia in the current issue of The New Yorker. He covers Southeast Asia for the magazine. The Cambodian Peace Accord emerged from a 19-nation conference held in Paris last October under the auspices of the UN. Here's the basics of the agreement.
It's a gargantuan job for the United Nations. They're undertaking a peace process that's never been tried before. It's the first major effort of the UN in the post-Cold War world to do something that's going to be very positive. They're going into Cambodia, and in effect, first of all, they're supervising the government in Phnom Penh. This is the government of Prime Minister Hun Sen, which is at odds with the other three factions that are also involved in the peace process. They're supervising the government to make certain that this government, which has been very rigid and totalitarian in the past, allows free elections. Then they're trying to disarm all the 400,000 soldiers in Cambodia of the four factions, the government and the three opposing factions. Then they're trying to bring back 330,000 refugees from Thailand and resettle them, even though Cambodia is strewn with mines, millions of mines, and the mine clearing process has just begun. And next year, what's supposed to emerge from this process is free and fair elections in a country that has never known free elections before. Cambodia is 80% rural, and the peasants in the villages of Cambodia have no idea what a vote is. And suddenly they're being confronted with the idea of different candidates for election, and the UN is supposed to somehow make this all comprehensible. And then on top of all this, no one knows where the $2 billion is going to come from, because there's always plenty of money to make war, but Congress and the administration and other countries are balking at paying for the peacekeeping efforts.
Do you see this in a way as an experiment on the UN's part to see how powerful the UN could be in keeping a peace?
If it's an experiment on the UN's part, they've taken probably the most difficult country in the world to do this with. Because after all, the Khmer Rouge, the mass murderers who killed 1.5 million Cambodians in the 1970s, are part of this so-called peace process. And how do you make the Khmer Rouge peaceful when their same leaders are still heading it?
Well, you compare including the Khmer Rouge in the peace process to if the Allies invited the Nazis back to participate in post-war German government. What's the official logic behind inviting the Khmer Rouge into the peace process?
The logic is that the Khmer Rouge are less dangerous participating in the peace, running against the other factions in elections, than they would be on the Thai border as a military force. And that on the Thai border, they would always be destabilizing Cambodia. It's an argument that is open to lots of criticism.
Do you buy the argument?
No, I personally don't, because the Khmer Rouge... Well, you have to go back a little into history. If the United States is equated to Dr. Frankenstein, the Khmer Rouge is the monster that Dr. Frankenstein created. The Khmer Rouge were able to take over Cambodia only because Cambodia was completely destabilized by American bombing of Cambodia starting in 1969 and by an American-inspired coup in 1970 under which a right-wing general named Lon Nol overthrew Prince Sihanouk and took control of Cambodia and then started to loot the country. And the Khmer Rouge took advantage of this destabilization and claimed to be nationalists who were restoring Cambodia to its own identity, taking it away from the Americans and the other foreigners who were looting the country. And the Khmer Rouge gained power that way. Then they started their mass murders. And then in 1979, Vietnam felt so threatened by the Khmer Rouge, the Pol Pot government, that Vietnam invaded Cambodia and drove the Khmer Rouge out. And at this point, the Khmer Rouge were nothing. They could have been destroyed. But the United States, China, and Thailand chose to support the Khmer Rouge on the Thai border. All during the 1980s, the United States voted for the Khmer Rouge each year to hold the seat in the United Nations, the Cambodian seat. And this was all done because of the American blind hatred of Vietnam.
So what do you think the United States government thinks of the Khmer Rouge now?
Well, I think the United States government, seeing this monster that they've created being back in Phnom Penh, hopes very much that our old enemy, the Hun Sen government, originally installed by Vietnam, wins the elections. It's the ultimate irony. We did everything we could to nourish the Khmer Rouge during the 1980s, and now they're back in Phnom Penh as part of the peace process. And now suddenly they might win. They might actually regain Cambodia through the peace process because the Hun Sen government is so corrupt that the Cambodians are turning against it. It's the same situation as when General Lon Nol was raping the country in the early 1970s.
I don't know, given the choice, if I had it between corruption and death, I'd choose corruption.
but the Khmer Rouge have a nice line. I mean, they're playing to the rural population. Of course, no one in Phnom Penh is going to support the Khmer Rouge, but Phnom Penh has 900,000 people, less than 10% of the population of Cambodia, and farmers who are illiterate, who have no concept of what the Khmer Rouge have done when they see all the corruption in Phnom Penh and when they see nothing at all going to the rural areas, and then the Khmer Rouge come in and with this campaign that we're going to restore you, we're going to bring you the resources that you need so much, that we're going to support you and we're going to get rid of these people in Phnom Penh. It has appeal in the rural areas. No one knows how much appeal it has, but again, the Khmer Rouge, if they don't succeed in the elections after a number of tries, and they're being very patient, if they don't succeed in the elections, they're undoubtedly going to try again to succeed militarily.
What are the American interests now in Cambodia?
The American interests in Cambodia, the United States has never had any interests in Cambodia, really. We've used Cambodia to bomb the areas near Vietnam in the 1960s and 1970s, and we've had no economic interest in Cambodia. We've had no close ties with Cambodia. Cambodia means nothing to the United States except as a buffer between Vietnam and pro-Western Thailand. But now, the only interest in Cambodia is that Cambodia alone could destabilize all of Southeast Asia. We have Vietnam throwing off its traditional communist economy and opening up to the West and stabilizing, and Laos doing the same thing, and China at peace with Vietnam and Laos, and Thailand looking upon Indochina as a marketplace. And here's Cambodia in the middle of all this, threatening to wreck the whole rebuilding of Southeast Asia.
Future joining us, my guest is Stan Sesser. He's a staff writer for The New Yorker and covers Southeast Asia. He has an article about Cambodia in the current issue of The New Yorker. One of the Khmer Rouge who's returned to Cambodia is Sun Sen, and he was the Khmer leader who oversaw torture of those about to be executed. What's he doing now? And I wonder if you talked to him or tried to talk to him?
No, the Khmer Rouge don't grant interviews.
Right,
they're not. They don't have much of a public relations setup. Some reporters get to them, but it takes a decade of cultivation to be able to talk to them. There's really only one Western reporter who's able to talk to Khmer Rouge officials, and I'm not able to. And what Son Sen is doing is he's taking orders. Son Sen and Khoo Sampan, the two Khmer Rouge leaders who are in Phnom Penh now, are taking orders from Pol Pot. Pol Pot's on the Thai border being supported by the Thai army, and Pol Pot is determining the future of Cambodia. And no one knows just what the game plan of the Khmer Rouge is going to be.
Prince Sihanouk ruled Cambodia from 1943 until 1970, when he was overthrown by Lon Nol with the help of America. So what is Prince Sihanouk's reputation now that he's returned to Cambodia?
Sihanouk is still looked upon as the only leader who can keep Cambodia together. His participation in the peace process is of extreme importance. And no one knows whether Sihanouk can be trusted or not. He's made so many shifts. In the West, Sihanouk's reputation is being pretty flaky and not trustworthy. But others in Phnom Penh say that all these, the mercurial nature of Sihanouk is due to his having to move back and forth in a desperate situation and attempt to salvage his country. When the United States was bombing it, when the Khmer Rouge were doing what they did, Sihanouk has been pressed and has had so few resources, and this might account for his desperate efforts to ally with whatever faction, with whatever country will support him. And right now he's playing the role of a diplomat, and he's very impressive. He's very impressive to watch. He's really playing the role of a king.
What is the mood about the election scheduled for the spring of 1993 in Cambodia? What's the mood inside Cambodia? Are people optimistic about them?
Well, no one knows quite how it's going to happen. How do you have free elections when, first of all, there's no newspaper that's not controlled by the government? Radio and television is controlled by the government. The whole road system of Cambodia is in ruins. How do you reach all the villages? Landmines are everywhere. The refugees have to be resettled first before they can start voting, and only 10,000 are going to be resettled by June 1st when the monsoons come. And how will the rest of the 320,000 remaining refugees get back? And then how do you teach people about elections? It's quite a test for the UN to see whether they can pull this off. And then, to top it all off, it seems that all the independent candidates who announce that they're going to start their own political parties are getting knocked off by a mysterious death squad that people suspect is part of the Interior Ministry, but no one knows for sure.
And the UN peacekeeping force isn't able to control that.
Well, how do you stop people? They're like mafia hitmen. They're riding through the streets of Phnom Penh shooting at independent candidates. And you really can't stop that. And that's a real worry. You're superimposing on a country that's known nothing but violence. Suddenly, the system of free elections, as if they're going to go from hundreds of years of violence and despotism to an American-style democracy overnight. Can it be done? Can this happen? I don't know. A lot of other countries in Southeast Asia, they're supposedly a lot freer, are still having problems with democracy.
Stan, let me reintroduce you. My guest is Stan Susser. He writes about Southeast Asia for The New Yorker, where he's a staff writer. His article about Cambodia is in the current edition of the magazine. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
We're talking about the peacekeeping process being overseen by the United Nations in Cambodia, and my guest is journalist Stan Sesser. What happens after the elections in May 1993 when the UN peacekeeping forces leave? I mean, even if the elections go really well, do you have any faith that the country would remain stable after the UN forces are gone?
Well, first of all, the Hun Sen government is certain to be elected. The Khmer Rouge aren't going to win the first time. There has to be a lot more problems with the country, a lot more corruption before the Khmer Rouge have a chance. So the Hun Sen government will be elected. And then the UN leaves, and then the problems start, because the Hun Sen government itself is not unified. Hun Sen is a relative liberal, but at least a very large part of the government consists of the old line Stalinists who are interested in liberalization of the economy only to the extent that they can make more money off of it, because it will bring more goods and money into the country and will enhance their opportunities for corruption. And then what happens when the UN leaves? Corruption will increase even more, and eventually the country just has to turn against this, as it turned against Lon Nol in the 1970s. And the Khmer Rouge are there hoping to profit by it.
I have to say, you know, this is such a massive campaign on the part of the United Nations to create peace and some form of democracy in Cambodia. And you sound so really skeptical that Cambodia really can change right now. Do you think that this is something of a pointless exercise?
I don't think it's a pointless exercise, because I think it sets a very important precedent. The idea of UN intervention will have to be worked out over a period of years, or who knows, maybe decades, to make it an effective force. And it's going to be more effective in some places, for instance, as it has been in Namibia, than it perhaps will be in Cambodia. But I think it's a very important precedent. I don't think that we can allow the United States to be the one superpower in the world that will dictate the fate of countries like Cambodia. I mean, look at what's happened over, look at all the damage the United States has caused in Cambodia from when our bombing started in 1969 through the 1980s with our tacit support of the Khmer Rouge. It's been devastating. And I would much rather have the decisions in the hands of the UN than in the hands of the United States. And Cambodia, the effort in Cambodia might fail, but I think it's an important effort. And I might be wrong. It might succeed. And if it succeeds, the UN has pulled off a miracle and can do it anywhere else in the world, Yugoslavia and anywhere else, if they can get through the thicket of Cambodia.
I'm interested in hearing how the Khmer Rouge have permanently changed the face of Cambodia. You have a really horrifying statistic in your piece in The New Yorker. You're talking about how the Khmer slaughtered everyone with an education. And there are, you say, 43 of 485 doctors who survived the reign of the Khmer Rouge.
Yeah, it's astonishing to be in Cambodia now and see what has happened. Essentially, you have a situation where a large number of people with intelligence are dead, and the people left. I mean, all the posts of government have to be staffed now with the people who survived, and all the intellectuals and all the scholars and all the teachers and all the doctors are dead, and it's a real problem. It's a real problem finding people to do things. You can't even... Autos can't be repaired in Cambodia. From tiny little things, they have to bring in Vietnamese to repair their cars. And there are no doctors in the hospitals, and there's no medical equipment, and there are no teachers. And all this has to be created from scratch, and the country is devastated. It's just devastated.
Stan, how about a little history lesson in why the Khmer singled out people with education and slaughtered them?
They had a theory. This Kusampan was one of the two Khmer Rouge leaders who are now in Phnom Penh. Was their theorist. He was an intellectual, educated in Paris, and he The theory was one of Cambodia regaining its nationality. It's Cambodia has always been under French domination and then Japanese and then American and then in Vietnamese. The theory was that to regain its identity as a nation, the peasants have to rise up and overthrow the educated classes, because the educated classes were tools of the corrupt foreigners and were being used by the corrupt foreigners for the foreigners' own purpose. And the theory was that there was just no place for educated people. Then later in the Khmer Rouge years, it turned into just massive paranoia, where the Khmer Rouge were not only killing doctors and teachers, but they were killing their own people, their own officials. There were massive purges. It was sort of like Stalin in the early 1950s, where they didn't even trust themselves.
I want to get back to something you were saying earlier. You said that when it comes to the elections, a lot of the rural people could conceivably vote for the Khmer Rouge because they really didn't know about many of the atrocities committed under the Khmer. That's kind of hard to believe.
No. They knew about the atrocities, but the atrocities, in a way, affected them less than it did the people of the cities. It was the educated people of the cities who were being murdered.
I see.
In many instances, the rural people were given positions of authority within the Cambodian government. Uneducated peasants were given positions of authority. That's the first thing. But the second thing is that people are much more concerned in Cambodia with what's happening now, with an effort to restore their lives, than they are with what happened 15 years ago. And what they see now is causing tremendous resentment when they see the prosperity of Phnom Penh and when there's nothing whatsoever going into the rural areas. And you look at Phnom Penh and you see all these people getting rich, and you look at yourself and you see that you can't feed your family. And the Khmer Rouge come along and they say, we're the only alternative. We're opposed to all this. As Khoo Samphan, one of the Khmer Rouge leaders, said on a radio broadcast last November, he said, let's forget the past. It's ironic, the Cambodian peasantry today doesn't have the luxury of remembering the past.
Well, Stan Sesser, I want to thank you very much for talking with us about Cambodia. Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
Stan Sesser is a staff writer at The New Yorker magazine. He writes about Southeast Asia. His article about Cambodia is in the current edition of The New Yorker. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. What do you do when you're an actress who doesn't want to take roles that exploit women? Coming up, we ask actress Christine Lottie, who's turned down her share of such roles. Lottie stars in the new movie Leaving Normal and also starred in Housekeeping, Running on Empty, and Swing Shift. Strangers and Red Shoe Diaries are two dramas that offer something only the cable channels can provide, sex. TV critic David Bianculli has a review. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. In Los Angeles, court proceedings have been postponed for three suspects arrested in connection with the beating of truck driver Reginald Denny. He was pulled from his truck and attacked at the very start of the L.A. violence. NPR's Patricia Naiman reports.
Since the Los Angeles Police Department has come under fire for not responding fast enough to the rioting, there's been strong political pressure to find and convict those who attacked truck driver Reginald Denny. In a series of pre-dawn raids on Tuesday, about 200 police officers and FBI agents arrested three men who allegedly beat Denny nearly to death. The men were identified with the help of a videotape made by a local TV station and turned over to the police. Today, in a courtroom packed with reporters and relatives of the accused, defense lawyers successfully argued to postpone arraignment. The judge refused to lower bail or release the defendants on their own recognizance. The three suspects are now scheduled to be formally charged 1 week from today. In Los Angeles, I'm Patricia Naiman reporting.
On Capitol Hill, the House has approved a measure providing more than $800 million in loans and grants to help businesses destroyed in recent rioting in Los Angeles. Some of the money also goes to aid in rebuilding after flooding in Chicago. The measure passed on a vote of 244 to 162 and now goes on to the Senate. President Bush, who met with some members of Congress today, said he's optimistic about an amendment calling for a balanced budget. Lawmakers have considered such a move before, but support has grown over the last year as voters indicate their unhappiness over Washington's handling of the federal deficit and the U.S. economy. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
Republican lawmakers who emerged from the meeting with the president said they thought Congress would pass such an amendment by mid-June. It would then be sent to the states for ratification. President Bush, who has never submitted a balanced budget to Congress since he's been in office, says he's been pushing for the requirement for years. While lawmakers are quick to embrace the goal of the amendment, they are admittedly reluctant to take the steps necessary to achieve a balanced budget, raising taxes, cutting spending, or a combination of both. Opponents of the measure say it's political grandstanding that could prove devastating to the economy. House Budget Committee Chairman Leon Panetta and others who take a dim view of the amendment are considering submitting it along with other legislation that would call on lawmakers to vote for specific spending cuts or new revenue measures at the same time. I'm Elizabeth Arnold in Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down over 23 points to close at 3,368.88 on volume of some 188 million shares. This is NPR News. Nova Scotia rescue teams have ended their search for 10 coal miners missing since a gas explosion last weekend. 16 bodies have been found, but a spokesman for the Plymouth mine says there is no longer hope for those still not accounted for. Officials said a search was suspended because conditions are unsafe for rescuers. Libya says it will comply with a UN resolution requiring Tripoli to end its support of terrorism. Barnaby Mason of the BBC reports this announcement may ease tension between Libya and the West, but Tripoli will not extradite two suspects wanted for questioning in connection with the bombing of a Western jetliner.
Colonel Gaddafi has said over the past few months of confrontation with the West that he's no longer backing groups which Libya thought were freedom fighters, but which now turn out, as he puts it, to be terrorists. The statement now issued in Tripoli goes a bit further. It formally renounces terrorism and says Libya is taking steps to cut all its links with international terrorist organizations. The statement doesn't name any groups or individuals. It says Libya is prepared to banish anyone proven to be involved in terrorist acts and gives another assurance that there are no terrorist training camps on Libyan territory. On the face of it, all this goes some way to meeting some parts of Security Council Resolution 731, but it says nothing specific on the issue at the heart of Libya's confrontation with the West, the demand that it should hand over men accused of being responsible for bomb attacks on Western airliners.
Barnaby Mason of the BBC. Heavy fighting in Bosnia has trapped some 350 members of a UN peacekeeping force in the capital. According to a UN spokesman, a ceasefire was shattered when Muslim forces attacked a Serbian stronghold near the airport. In turn, Federal Army tanks and Serbian guns hit the center of the city. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. There aren't many great roles for actresses in Hollywood. Christine Lotti is selective about what she takes and stands out in just about any role she gets. She starred as an eccentric aunt in Housekeeping, a radical activist forced to live underground with her family and running on empty, and a tough and spirited factory worker in the World War II homefront film Swing Shift. On Broadway, she starred in The Heidi Chronicles. Perhaps you saw her in the telemovie No Place Like Home, about a woman whose family ends up homeless. Now she's starring in Leaving Normal as a cynical cocktail waitress named Darley who leaves her Wyoming town to hit the road with her friend Marianne and start a new life in Alaska. It's a role Lotti was very glad to get.
Darley Peters is one of the greatest roles I've ever read. She's so complex. She's really funny and seemingly all together and tough and confident, but underneath, she's got this incredibly dark hole, this place of self-loathing and insecurity and low self-esteem. And she's so many colors, so many different things to play, and I really fell in love with her.
You love this character. I'm wondering if you feel disappointed by the critical response to the film.
Yeah, I do. I mean, I didn't read too many reviews, but I understand that they were very mixed.
The reviews of the film were mixed. The ones I read were uniformly good about you and your performance in it.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah.
But it is disappointing that more people didn't get the film, because I really love the film, and I think that it's so great to have a film about women. First of all, that's a very rare thing these days, and I think it's unfair and disappointing that it's compared to Thelma and Louise so much, because the similarities between the two movies are so superficial, and I think that they shouldn't be compared, and certainly Leaving Normal shouldn't be dismissed because it was supposedly trying to rip off Thelma and Louise and didn't quite make it, because the truth is the script of Leaving Normal was around even before the script of Thelma and Louise was around, so that part's unfair.
Give me a sense of how difficult it is to find good roles for an actress, you know? What you're up against when people send you scripts?
Well, I think it's always been tough for women in Hollywood, except, of course, in the 40s. For some reason, there were so many wonderful parts for women. And I don't know whether it's because of a backlash against feminism, which I think is very real, or because movies about women supposedly don't make money. I don't know what the reasons are, but there are very few good parts for women. It's changing a little bit. I mean, with the success of movies like Thelma and Louise and Fried Green Tomatoes, more movies like Leaving Normal and will be made. And that's the bottom line, I think, is if movies about women make money, then there'll be more of them.
Do you often turn down roles because you think that they're dumb portrayals of women or offensive portrayals of women?
I do. I've always turned down roles that I felt were exploitive and portrayed women in a less than three-dimensional way. And there's so many of those movies. I mean, we've all seen them.
Yes, we have.
I know. And they're offensive to me and to a lot of women I know, and I don't want to be a part of those movies. That really narrows it down, though, because that means that I can't play an accessory kind of girlfriend decoration part. So that's like 90% of all the parts for women. And I can't be in movies that are excessively violent, and especially violent towards women, so that rules out another huge percentage of the movies. So the truth is, it's hard to find really good three-dimensional, complex leading parts for women.
My guest is Christine Lottie. She starred in such films as Housekeeping, Swing Shift, Running on Empty, and The Doctor. Her new film is Leaving Normal. We'll take a short break, then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Christine Lottie is my guest. Now, I read that when you went to college, University of Michigan at Ann Arbor, mm-hmm. that you joined a sorority, then quickly dropped out.
Yeah. I lasted
This is 1968, right?
Yeah, 1968. And I lasted one semester in that sorority, Delta Gamma, and I left very quickly. And I was going through a lot of changes then, as were many of my peers at that time, and decided that a sorority was probably the last thing I should be in, and I was really reevaluating everything I had ever learned and rejecting just about everything I'd ever learned, as we all did back then, and decided that the whole thrust of the sorority was to get these girls, young girls, married. That seemed to be the main focus, was that not about careers or about empowerment or developing other qualities to feel, you know, proud of it within yourself. But it was really, the focus was to try to find a man, and I found that finally pretty offensive.
So how did you change your life after leaving the sorority?
Well, I became a hippie really fast, which of course meant that a lot of it was superficial, and then years later it became, I think, integrated into my value system. But I moved into an apartment with some girlfriends and became quite active politically, although never too active, because I was always rehearsing plays. I was always involved in some kind of production at the university, or in street theater, or in coffee shops. I was doing a lot of theater.
How did you start becoming aware of the women's movement?
Well, I had this sort of feminist epiphany when I was in New York City. I moved to New York, and I was very determined never to sell out and do commercials or anything horrifying like that, because I was a real artiste. You know, I thought of myself that way. And then I faced the realities of waitressing and not being able to get an agent, and just not having any luck professionally. So I changed my mind after about a year and a half of this kind of life, and decided that probably the best thing in life would be to find a sell out and to find a national commercial. So I went on a lot of auditions, and I was just too weird. I never quite looked like a housewife enough, and I didn't shave my legs, and that was a big problem. And I was like a gypsy, this one agent said. Could you not look so much like a gypsy, Christine? Could you try to look like a housewife more? So I wasn't having a lot of luck, and I answered this ad in the trades, and this I went up to meet this casting director, and he said, let me take some pictures. I think I might have a couple of national commercials for you. So he took some pictures, and he called me up the next day, and he said, come into my office. I don't want to tell you this over the phone. So I thought, well, that's weird, but I went up to his office, and he said, You have landed two national commercials. And I said, oh my God, that's incredible. When do I audition? And he said, oh, no, you don't have to audition. See, I showed your pictures to some director friends of mine, and you are exactly the type they're looking for. And slowly it dawned on me that this guy was a pimp for his director friends, and I would have to sleep with these director friends to get these national commercials. So I was shocked and appalled and horrified. And when I turned him down, he said I was a fool. That basically I was not special enough. I had no connections in the business, and how was I going to make it unless I slept my way to the top? So that I left his office. I was very angry and crying. I remember walking in the streets of New York for hours. And that was my epiphany, the moment. I mean, it was the day I became a real feminist, and I was determined to get ahead by making choices that afforded me self-respect and accountability.
Did you ever get your national commercials?
I did. I did Joy dishwashing liquid, where you can the woman looks into the plate and says, "Hey, I can see myself in the plate." So that was one, and that was great. Luckily, I got to play my son's softball coach, or what do you call them?
Little League
manager or something. So I was able to rationalize. At least I wasn't just a housewife. I was also this little league coach. We there's wonderful ways in which we all can rationalize just about anything we do.
By then, were they convinced that you looked more like, a middle American homemaker or something? You know.
Well, yeah, I did. I did finally style my hair, and I think I did finally shave my legs, and that was a step in the right direction. But I still never looked. I tried. I really tried to look like those gals, and I just never quite made that.
So did the national commercials help get you theater or film roles? I mean, does anybody watch the commercials and say, wow, she can really look at her reflection in a dish, let's get her for this part?
No. The truth is, I don't think I was good at those commercials. I really don't know how to act and sell a product and look into the camera. And I mean, this has nothing to do with acting.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I remember another one I did called Spray and Vac. That was a really fun one. I had my clothes were all Velcroed from the back, and I was wearing these like really grungy dungarees and a work shirt. And I said something like, "Now you don't have to look like this when you shampoo your rug. Now you can look like this." And my clothes were wired, and they were all flown off me. And underneath, I was wearing a really nice polyester ensemble. And then I said, "Now you can look like this when you shampoo your rug." Oh, God, the memories.
Oh, that's
memories.
Great.
Yeah. So, no, I was never good at them. I remember I really couldn't get the line out, the most important line of the copy saying, "Spray and Vac, the no scrub rug shampoo." That was the final, like, button. And I was so nervous and so uncomfortable. And it was so against everything, I guess, that I believed in, but I needed the money. So I would say, "Spray and Vac, the no scrub, scrub, cut. Spray and Vac, the no scrub, scrub." Cut, and maybe 50 takes. I had to say I couldn't say it. It was like it was writing on the wall. I should have really looked at that at that point.
So how did you get your breaks into stage and movies?
Well, I did about a dozen, maybe 13, 14 off Broadway plays for no money, but it was really great training. I did all kinds of plays, and then I guess my big break on stage was at the Public Theater, the New York Shakespeare Festival. I did David Mamet's play called The Woods, directed by Ulu Grosbard, and it was a two-character play, myself and Chris Sarandon, and that was, I think, for me, it was my big break. And I won a Theater World Award, which is the award they give to newcomers on the stage in New York. And then after that came some television and then my first movie was Injustice for All.
Mm-hmm. If you don't mind my asking, it seems to me something that most or at least many actresses and also many women on TV face in their 40s is the plastic surgery question, because you're expected to like not have any wrinkles.
Right.
And to maybe like fix that nose or something. But mostly, you know, like when you enter your 40s, it's the question of wrinkles. How are you going to resist that?
Well, I have so far. I've been, I'm very, it's a real dilemma. I mean, I think a lot of women, especially when they get into their late 40s, maybe early 50s, they face the question of, well, do I get a facelift or do I never work again?
Yeah,
or do I become invisible? And I really would hate to succumb to that kind of philosophy. I've I've never been invisible. As a feminist, I've always struggled for, I guess, visibility and empowerment. And to suddenly accept that kind of philosophy seems completely ridiculous to me. Although it may be a reality, I may really have to face that decision someday. I think it's premature now, but it might be down the line for me. But frankly, I see myself going back to the stage and having a really wonderful career on stage. And if film parts for women in their late 40s and early 50s are non-existent, then I will be very happy to be on stage and maybe direct. I'm not sure. That seems to be an option a lot of women who have chosen not to try to get on the youth mobile, you know, which right. seems like a never-ending process. If you start with a nip and a tuck there, then what about here and then? And it's also sort of horrific to me. But a lot of women who've chosen not to go on to that path seem to turn to directing, which is an exciting option.
Mm-hmm. Well, Christine Lotti, I wish you the best, and I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Well, thanks. It was fun.
Christine Lotti stars in the film Leaving Normal. This is Fresh Air. Time to see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert Siegel's with us. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry. We'll be hearing today about the progress of the Intelsat 6 satellite, which was powered on its way to its proper higher orbit after being repaired inside the space shuttle Endeavour last night. Also today, we'll be hearing about how an enterprise zone, sort of thing that's being recommended now following the L.A. riots, has actually worked in Baltimore, Maryland. It doesn't seem to have provided all that many jobs for the people who live in the zone. A talk with Senator Bill Bradley of New Jersey about race relations, a subject that over the past several months he's been addressing on the floor of the Senate and elsewhere, and also the death of the creator of the margarita.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The two major pay cable networks, HBO and Showtime, are competing this month in a battle that won't be joined by the broadcast networks, the battle to present the sexiest anthology series. Earlier this month, HBO premiered a weekly series called Strangers, in which strange people meet under often strange circumstances. This weekend, Showtime presents the telemovie pilot for a forthcoming series called Red Shoes Diaries, in which a young man reads and imagines the intimate thoughts of young women. TV critic David Bianculli has seen both of these adult series and has this review.
First of all, let's establish what's going on here. The premium channels, the ones you pay extra for on top of your monthly cable fee, had a bad year last year. So they finally wised up that the way for them to get and keep more subscribers is to offer more stuff they can't get anywhere else. Not just movies, which eventually can be rented from local video stores, but original programming. Programming the networks aren't providing. In the area of children's TV, that means Showtime's Shelley Duvall's Fairy Tale Theater. In comedy, it means HBO's Dream On, where the language and situations are more adult than broadcast network censors will allow. In suspense, it means Tales from the Crypt, also from HBO, which is the most warped and one of the most enjoyable shows on TV. And borrowing an idea that until now has been largely monopolized by the Playboy Channel, HBO and Showtime are going after viewers by offering sex. Sexy TV dramas, that is. HBO's Strangers is from the producers of The Hitchhiker, and it's set in Paris, but not because that's the best place to tell stories about romance. Like The Hitchhiker, Strangers is an international co-production, which means it's pre-sold to French TV as well as American cable. The deal is, each episode has to be set in France, feature at least one French actor, and use a largely French crew. As a result, Strangers is about as intimate and compelling as a board of directors meeting. It's all business and very little pleasure. In the episodes I've seen, the biggest star has been Joan Chen from Twin Peaks. She's good, but the writing isn't.
I feel sort of strange. No, actually, I feel really strange. You know, I don't feel. I can't feel completely.
Showtime's Red Shoe Diaries, on the other hand, is directed and co-written by Zalman King, who co-wrote 9½ Weeks and several other notoriously erotic movies. The pilot episode, a full-length telemovie, is about a young woman, played by Bridget Bako, who's killed herself, and the fiancé she left behind. He finds and reads her diary and learns about her secret life with another man. First, he reads each entry, then we see her sexual encounters acted out, and sometimes hear her inner thoughts at the same time.
The minute I saw him, I understood what I wanted. Something I'd never had in my life. Something I've always gladly given up to others. The greatest aphrodisiac of all. Control.
This first-person commentary is what pushes Red Shoe Diaries above the norm in this genre. David Duchovny, who played the cross-dressing FBI agent in Twin Peaks, stars as the young man, who in future episodes will solicit and read other women's diaries. And actually, here's where broadcasting on public radio has its drawbacks. I can't play much of the dialogue from either of these series. And while Bako was talking about control in that scene, she was simultaneously touching and licking and doing some things I might not be able to show, even if this were public TV. If Red Shoe Diaries were a theatrical film, it'd be rated R for both language and sexual content. And that's exactly what Showtime is after. Future episodes will feature such actresses as Joan Severance from Wise Guy and Denise Crosby from Star Trek The Next Generation. It's a higher class of production than Strangers, which HBO is showing at midnight on Fridays. Red Shoes, with all its erotic scenes, is placed squarely in the middle of primetime on Saturday night. It has a touch of class. Strangers, on the other hand, has a touch of crass.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Post. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Joan Tuohy, with Sue Weinstein, Sue Spolin, and Lisa Bruton. Welcome back, Lisa, even if it's just for a few days between your travels. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, I talk with cinematographer and director Ed Lockman. The impressive list of people he's worked with includes Wim Wenders, Werner Herzog, Bernardo Bertolucci, Paul Schrader, and David Byrne. Also, we'll talk with Frances Lear, the founder of Lear's Magazine and the author of a new memoir. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.